Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. I've been asked to talk about Brexit and its impact on the European Union and the impact of the European Union on post-Brexit Britain. It's a very useful way to begin any conversation about the future of Europe. Allow me to just begin with the news of the day, because it is always useful to juxtapose the big picture with what is happening today. The big picture is going to be, if you want, my working hypothesis, which I shall try to convey to you, and that is very simply that after the Great Recession that followed the events of 2008, we are now in the clasp of a great deflation on both sides of the Atlantic, especially in Europe, and that Brexit is a mere symptom of this great deflation, but a symptom with a capacity to introduce dynamic effects, mutual reinforcement, hopefully not negative, but likely negative, between Brexit, the Brexit process, and developments within the European Union. That will be the big picture. But let's start with the news of the day. If you pick up any of the financial newspapers, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, you'll see very prominently the President of the European Union Council's statement yesterday that it's either hard Brexit or no Brexit. Clearly, Brussels, in its infinite wisdom, believes that this is a time to up the ante and to play hardball with London. This is just another symptom of the crisis, the political crisis, the crisis of leadership that we find ourselves in. Another piece of news, which worries many of our friends in London, is that we have completed 36 weeks of outflows from Eurobond funds. We have large redemptions by continental funds from London. And thirdly, this is a story that has been permeating now for a few days, and it will stay with us for the foreseeable future, all the speculation about the European Central Bank's tapering of Mario Draghi's QE. But let me unpack these three pieces of news before returning to my working hypothesis. Let's begin with Mr. Tusk and his hardball strategy of going to London, effectively to tell them, well, either you rescind the referendum outcome or you are out, in a manner which will be mutually disadvantageous for the European Union and for the United Kingdom. My experience, short-lived, only 6 months, but extremely intense, allows me to convey to you my greatest worry about this process. And my greatest worry is that it's not that the negotiations are not going to proceed in a friendly and efficient manner. My great worry is that there will be no negotiations. In the 6 months in which I was mandated by the Greek people to negotiate with Brussels, there were no negotiations. There was a pretense negotiation. We would go to Brussels, we would put forward proposals, they were never looked at properly by the other side, they were rejected, there were no proposals coming from Brussels to us, never, in spite of the reports that we didn't have any proposals. It was a very clear case where, and that was said to me on a number of occasions behind closed doors, that a mutually advantageous negotiated settlement between the Greek government and Brussels and Frankfurt would be the worst nightmare of the Troika, of the establishment of the European Union, because it would signal to the people of Spain, to the people of Portugal, and eventually to the people of France next May, that they have the opportunity to elect people like me and still get a good agreement with the European Union. I believe that the same mindset, the same destructive mindset, may torpedo the negotiations between Brussels and London. When Mr. Tusk is saying that it's either hard Brexit or no Brexit, effectively, he's heralding a lack of interest in having a serious negotiation that will be mutually advantageous. Why? Because as President Hollande and other European leaders have said, if Britain gets a deal which is decent, which is honorable, which is good in the end for both sides, then that is going to give ideas to other European leaders, for instance, in Italy, in Poland, in Hungary, that they may start the process of negotiating with Brussels. This is perhaps the reason why a degree of pessimism about the future of Europe is called for. But hopefully I will end my talk with some optimism. Only because we must. Otherwise, it is very hard to get out of bed in the morning and do good things. Now, let's go to the second part. The impact of this kind of narrative about Brexit on markets, companies, the financial sector, Britain's economy more generally. Now, there's no doubt that the slide of sterling was long overdue. The current account surplus was utterly unsustainable. The Bank of England has said so a number of times. But of course, we should, especially you, being members of a particular industrial sector, we should always look at the mixed blessings that come with such a decline in the pound. For instance, on the one hand, take a bank, take a foreign bank operating through in London. It is almost indeterminate what effect it will have on its bottom line. On the one hand, the slide of the pound reduces a foreign bank's London costs, while at the same time reducing the sterling profits that it is making within the United Kingdom. There is no spreadsheet that can deliver an answer to the question, which of the two forces is more powerful? Similarly, we can see already from the London Stock Exchange and reports from within the corporate sector of Britain that the slide of the pound is causing a redistribution of corporate power within the United Kingdom. Corporates that are UK-based but have most of their income coming from abroad, from overseas, they are gaining strength, whereas UK-based and locally focused companies are losing out. Again, it is impossible at this stage, when the politicians are engaged in a kind of tug of war, to predict how this is going to pan out. Lastly, the third story that I mentioned today, the European Central Bank. Now, in the United States, Janet Yellen, at some point, decided that tapering was right from a monetary policy perspective. She may have been right, she may have been wrong, but it was the considered opinion of the central bankers of the United States that determined the moment tapering would happen, the moment interest rates would start edging upwards. In the European Union, we have a European Central Bank, which is the least independent central bank in the history of capitalism. Even though Mario Draghi and the Executive Council like to proclaim their great independence, there is no central bank which is less independent than the European Central Bank. Let me give you an example which is pertinent to this discussion about tapering. Unlike the Federal Reserve, whose tapering was determined by its own assessment of the monetary conditions of the nation and markets, in the case of the European Central Bank, the very structure, the very architecture of quantitative easing is actually quite terrible. It is a structure that Mario Draghi did not want. Remember, the European Central Bank, in its charter, has a clause which prohibits it from purchasing bonds, effectively. Jens Weidmann, the president of the Bundesbank, has been at war with the European Central Bank since OMT was the predecessor of QE was announced. The only way that Mario Draghi could push through QE, and had he not done that, the Eurozone would not exist today, was by means of that favorite strategy of the European Union, the fudge. So the fudge was very simple. This is not going to be a bond purchasing program, really. What we are trying to do, Mario said, was to repair the mechanism for transmitting interest rate policy throughout the Eurozone area. That has broken down, so we are reducing interest rates almost to zero, but in Italy and in Spain, they remain very high. Why? Because, of course, of the significant probability that these banks, or the banks of these nations, the banking systems of these nations, in the absence of a proper banking union, will simply not be able to survive without a bailout from states that are fiscally squeezed and cannot provide it. So the whole rationale of bond purchasing was phrased through the rationale of fixing the interest rate mechanism, the transmission mechanism. But in order to overcome the Constitutional Court of Germany's potential annulment of QE, they had to say, well, all our bond purchases are going to take place in proportion to the relative GDP of every nation within the Eurozone. So of every 100 euros of bonds purchased, 27 must be bunds, and far fewer Italian or Spanish debt. Yeah? Which means that to counter the deflationary process in Spain, the deflationary process in Portugal, the deflationary process in Italy, Mario Draghi is forced to, he doesn't want to, but he's forced to, by the regulatory straitjacket in which he finds himself, to purchase more bonds than Portuguese debt, more bonds than Italian debt. The result of purchasing bonds at a time when the federal government in Germany is running a surplus is to create a shortage of bonds in Germany, therefore crushing the pension funds, crushing the smaller banks, and giving rise to the populist movement of the Alternative für Deutschland, which is making a great deal of headway on the basis that negative interest rates are eating into the Swabian housewives' savings. So, tapering in the European Central Bank's case is going to take place not because necessarily Mario Draghi and the Executive Council decided that it is time to taper, but because they've run out of bonds. And this is a great worry. When monetary policy is constrained by faulty architectural design, you know that we're in trouble. And that trouble transmits itself from the realm of monetary policy to the realm of politics. Thus, the rise of the AfD in Germany. A side effect of all this, of course, is that the European Central Bank, because Mario Draghi had to overcome all these legal issues, political constraints, the ECB's QE started very late. It started as America's QE was ending. That lack of synchronicity between the Bank of England, the Fed, and the European Central Bank has destabilized the global economy, and it's continuing to do so. From a European perspective, it is quite interesting that what Giscard d'Estaing once referred to in the 1960s as the dollar's exorbitant privilege may be challenged today by the fact that the ECB's tapering has not begun yet, and therefore corporations are effectively encouraged by the failure of synchronicity between central banks to borrow in euros as opposed to dollars. But that is another long conversation. Let's look now below the surface. Why did we find ourselves in this situation in Europe? Well, let's look back at the year 2009-2010, when the banks in Frankfurt and in Paris primarily, overnight, informed politicians that they needed a major bailout, and that if Greece started the domino effect that would topple Portuguese bonds, Irish bonds, and so on and so forth. French banks, for instance, would be utterly insolvent, given that three banks in France held 34% of French GDP's equivalent of these countries' bonds. Now, the difference between the Fed, another difference that you all know between the Fed and the ECB, is that in the United States, where the bailout had to be far less for Wall Street than what we had to do here in Europe, to give you an order of magnitude, per citizen of the United States, the bailouts were some like $285. The bailouts in the four major countries, Britain, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, that carried a lot of the sovereign debt of the Eurozone, the equivalent had to be about $10,000 per citizen, $285 to $10,000. On top of that, in the United States, Washington could take a large chunk of bad assets and park them on the books of the Fed and let them be there to be discovered by the monetary archaeologists of the future. The European Central Bank was created on the basis that the bad assets of the Latins and the Greeks would not be ever parked on the ECB's books. That was the condition that the Bundesbank and Berlin imposed. They had their own logic. I do not criticize it. It's a fact. So that they would share their Deutschmark with the rest of us. That's what the euro is. Given that these bailouts were firstly huge and secondly could not be mediated through the central bank in 2009-2010, has it ever made you wonder why austerity was embraced with such enthusiasm by the governments of Central Europe in 2009-2010, whereas it was not by the governments of Japan, of the United States, even of Britain? George Osborne was an austerian, but his austerity was like a walk in the park compared to our austerity. Of course, the reason is that if you need such huge bailouts of the banking system, and those huge bailouts have to be conducted by governments that no longer have printing presses, governments that don't have a central bank to back them, and a central bank that does not have a government to back it, then, of course, the only way of paying for these bailouts is through a cynical shift of bad assets from the books of the banks, effectively, to the shoulders of the taxpayers. And guess who those taxpayers are? The ones who cannot tax up. They have no tax immunity, unlike many others who do. Once you complete this shift, you end up with inexorable deflationary forces. An 8-year-old would understand why the moment you complete that shift, effectively through major reductions in public investment, in services, tax hikes, in my country, in Greece, which of course is not a country that should be mentioned in polite circles, but nevertheless, it's indicative. Maybe you don't know that, but we are the champions of austerity. Never before in the history of capitalism has such a severe austerity program been introduced. We had a consolidation of our structural deficit of 13% in 4 years. It has never happened before, at least not in peacetime. And the result, of course, was we lost 28% of nominal GDP, and our debt became utterly unsustainable. So in the deficit countries, we created the circumstances for a depression. And in the surplus countries, we created the circumstances of a great deflation, with negative interest rates being the natural repercussion of this gross imbalance between savings and investment, aggregate savings and investment. When aggregate savings is a multiple of aggregate investment, the price of money is going to fall. The tragedy is that, unlike the price of potatoes, when the price of potatoes falls, any excess supply of potatoes is eliminated. But when the price of money falls, during a period of deflation, things get worse. Because instead of looking at the fall in the price as a signal to invest, investors look at it as a sign that the central banker, who should know best or better, prognosticates a very bleak level of aggregate demand in the future. And why invest when the central bank prognosticates a drop in aggregate demand? Let's talk about Brexit in this context. The Brits always had a false sense of superiority, did they not? The great Winston Churchill, who famously spoke in favor of the United States of Europe. When he was speaking about the United States of Europe, he meant the United States of Europe without Britain in it. That's something that most people forget. And the splendid phrase he used was, "We are connected, we are linked with Europe, but we're not of Europe. We are connected, but not comprised." Now, at the time, it was perfectly sensible for the Prime Minister of Britain to imagine that there would be a United States of Europe and a British Empire side by side working together. Well, this is no longer possible. I have to grant my British friends that they have insights into the dysfunctionality of the European Union that the rest of us continental Europeans lacked. And I have to side with Brexiteers, even though I campaigned against Brexit in Britain, up and down the country. I have to side with them when they raise the very important point about parliamentary sovereignty. In Europe, our concern for liberal democracy and parliamentary democracy is much weaker than in Britain. And this is one of our great demerits as Europeans. We look at parliaments, we look at politics, at democratic liberal politics, in an instrumental fashion. We judge democracy on the basis of how useful it is to us. Whereas the Brits, being quite Burkean, especially, well, actually not especially, on both sides of, you know, both the Conservative and Labour Party, they have a tradition of seeing, correctly, democracy as an end in itself. However, the reason why Brexit happened was not that. The reason why it happened was because of the lack of synchronicity between monetary policy in Britain and in the European Union. The fact that the Bank of England did immediately what it could to refloat, firstly, finance, and secondly, the British economy, whereas Europe was caught in a question that was destructive. The question that our great and good leaders in the Eurogroup, in the European Union Council, in all the corridors of power were asking themselves was the wrong question. The question was not, how can we ensure that this crisis does not disintegrate Europe? The question they asked themselves was, well, this crisis has made a mockery of our rules. How can we pretend that our rules are still valid? It's not the same question. When you try to answer the second question, you end up with a comedy of errors like the one we've had over the last 6 years. So this lack of synchronicity is the one which is responsible for the fact that this false sense of superiority of the Brits was reinforced. They could see what was happening on the other side of the channel and were saying, oh, thank God, we didn't get into the euro. The fact that the British economy was not doing great, but it was doing far, far better than the continental economy, was what attracted hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Spaniards, of French, of Portuguese, of Greeks, of Romanians, of Bulgarians, to England, because the labor market was in a far better shape than it was on the continent. Combine the inept authoritarianism of Brussels, a deflationary process which always breeds political monsters that preach disintegration and bigotry, UKIP, for instance. And add to that the fact that my country was treated with a degree of contempt by the European Union and the European Central Bank that even those on the other side of politics, members of the Tory party, were writing emails to me during those negotiations saying, I disagree with you, we are on different sides of politics, but the way your democracy and your parliament is being abused is not one that we can tolerate. And what you have is a combination of parts of the Burkean Tory establishment wanting to get out, and the north of England in particular, which had been abandoned for 15 years as a result of gross mismanagement by both Labour and Conservative governments, coalescing and pointing accusatory fingers at the foreigners who had flooded into the country, and missing the point, which is the one I always make, that once you are in the European Union, you are in the clasps of what I call the Hotel California syndrome. You can check out, like they did on the 23rd of June, but you can't really leave. So let me finish on an optimistic note. How can we save Europe? Because Europe needs saving. We are at an advanced stage of disintegration. Brexit is only the first episode. Well, firstly, the Brexit negotiations must be rationalized. We must get rid of the Tusk mindset of stay or else. I think Theresa May made a mistake in already proclaiming a hard Brexit. I don't think that I, or maybe you, are the right people to tell the Brits what they should do. But what I think we should advise them to do is the following. Trigger Article 50 yesterday. Why wait until March? There will be no meaningful negotiations between now and March. Trigger it now. But at the same time say that the British government is going to seek an interim five-year agreement after the 2 years expire for a European Economic Area, Norway-style arrangement between the United Kingdom and the European Union. That would give Britain the opportunity to elect a new parliament after the end of those 2 years with a specific task, properly to debate what kind of relationship the United Kingdom wants with the European Union and with the rest of the world. Those 2 years are not enough to do this. The result of reaching some kind of conclusion within those 2 years will be disadvantageous both for Europe and the European Union. And then during those 5 years, with freedom of movement, with the customs union, with a single market, the verdict of Brexit will have been honored in the sense that Britain will no longer be in the European Union like Norway's not, and the people of Britain will have an opportunity to do that which they did not do prior to the referendum, to debate what kind of Brexit they want. This could be quite propitious, quite beneficiary to Europe as well, because in the European Union, we must have a discussion as well as to how to reformulate our central bank policy, to rewrite the charter of the central bank so the chairman, the president of the European Central Bank has at least as many degrees of freedom as Janet Yellen has, to map out a proper investment policy, unlike the Juncker plan, which was as if it was created to prove beyond reasonable doubt that we are excellent at creating logos and headlines utterly empty of content, and finally to decide what kind of Europe we want in terms of the relationship between the Eurozone countries, how many countries will be left in the Eurozone, how will any kind of exit or disintegration or fragmentation be handled, and how does this all fit within a single market and within a European continental policy that will make people like Vladimir Putin start worrying that Europeans maybe are getting their act together. Thank you.